Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, September 30th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from CHP Berkshires. Medical and dental care at practice locations in the Berkshires, now offering the 2025 COVID vaccine for all ages on CHP mobile clinics on the road, chpberkshires.org. Joining us this afternoon is cardiologist Dr. Robert Fang, Chief of Electrophysiology at St. Peter's Hospital. He specializes in heart rhythm disorders such as atrial fibrillation, ventricular tachycardia, and other heart conduction abnormalities. If you have a question for Dr. Fang today, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. We'll get it going after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us for Medical Monday is Dr. Robert Fang of Albany Associates in Cardiology. Dr. Fang is Chief of Electrophysiology at St. Peter's Hospital. He specializes in heart rhythm disorders such as atrial fibrillation, ventricular tachycardia, and other heart condition abnormalities. Dr. Fang received his medical degree from Stony Brook. He completed fellowships in clinical cardiac electrophysiology and cardiovascular disease, as well as a residence in internal medicine at Tufts. To be a part of the conversation today, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. That's the telephone number, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Robert Fang, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ray.
It's been a while. Remind me, what is a heart conduction abnormality?
Yes, so the electrical wiring of the heart starts with the sinus node, the pacemaker cells in the right upper chamber of the heart, and then the signal spread through the heart to other specialized tissue, and that spreads the electrical signal that leads to the heart's motion or contraction. So that signal, we see those signals on an EKG, for instance,
mm-hmm.
and some of those measurements tell us whether the conduction is abnormal or not.
And so this is a situation that would indicate a pacemaker?
So a pacemaker would be needed for very slow heart rates or abnormal conduction where the signals aren't getting through.
Mm.
And those missing beats will lead to symptoms of lightheadedness, near fainting or fainting. And a pacemaker corrects that or compensates for that problem.
And how is that different from AFib?
So AFib is not treated with a pacemaker. It's a fast, erratic rhythm. And instead of the normal beating starting in the atrium is literally fibrillating or quivering, shaking, with many, many rapid, irregular signals going on. And it originates from the left atrium. So it's a very different way of the heart beating.
Now, I've heard, and I don't know a great deal about it, but there is a device, it's a watchtower or something, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me, as a layman, to be, okay, this is similar to a pacemaker, but it accomplishes a somewhat different function.
Yeah, yes? Totally different. So, you know, in terms of the ways we treat AFib, there are kind of two important aspects we look at, and I'll get to the watchman part in a second.
Okay.
So a patient comes in, and they were diagnosed with AFib, and really the first thing I do is determine, are they symptomatic from it or not? You know, what kind of symptoms? And, you know, if I get 10 people in a row with atrial fibrillation, they all may describe a different experience.
Really?
So one would be, the most common would be an erratic or irregular palpitation.
And you'll feel that.
Yeah, you'll sense that your heart is actually beating, quivering, where obviously normally you don't feel anything in your chest when your heart's beating, right? So the sense of your heart beating faster and erratically, that's probably the most common symptom that we look for. But a really common other symptom is just being out of breath. Like you're normally walking, doing your daily activities, but now just going about one flight of stairs, carrying your laundry, doing things, you're out of breath, you lose stamina in atrial fibrillation, get more winded with exertion. These are common symptoms. Some people go as far as going into congestive heart failure. So it's quite variable what someone feels. And so those symptoms are addressed with trying to control the rhythm with drugs or procedures. And we'll come back to that. The other part of AFib treatment is a risk of stroke, and it's really the most critical, most dangerous part of AFib.
Why are you at a higher risk for stroke?
So as the atrium is quivering and not beating well, the blood is more stagnant in that chamber. Blood clots can form. Those blood clots can leave the heart and go to the brain, and that's a common mechanism for a stroke in the adult population and the elderly population. So that risk we have to determine. Will a person need a blood thinner to lower that risk? And then Watchman, where that comes in, it's a catheter procedure that we do at St. Peter's to basically plug up where the clots form in the atrium. And it's a way to get away from the blood thinner pills and live with a lower risk of bleeding by taking aspirin instead.
Why would the blood thinner pills be a threat?
So, yeah, living, you can imagine based on your lifestyle, right? If you are doing hiking in the Adirondacks, if you are playing sports that involve contact, if you are prone to falling and you're just
imbalanced. Oh, this is all about bleeding.
Yeah, it's all about bleeding.
But aspirin will do the same thing.
Well, at a much lower rate of risk of bleeding. So that is really an attractive option for a lot of patients to get away from the higher bleeding risks that they experience with these stronger blood thinner pills.
We're joined today by Dr. Robert Fang of Albany Associates in Cardiology, and the number to call is 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. When someone has AFib, they're always going to know it? They're always going to feel it?
No, that's a really good question. So another common scenario is that a primary care doctor will send someone to our clinic with newly diagnosed atrial fibrillation. They walked in for their physical. They were not complaining of anything in their chest. They're doing everything they normally do without any change. So I would consider that person truly asymptomatic or lacking any awareness or symptoms. But as I said before, sometimes it's a little subtle. Like if you got a little winded more than usual, you might say, I'm getting older, or I put on a few pounds this winter. Maybe that's what's making me more winded. And that might be true.
Right.
But it also could be from the AFib. So sometimes it's hard to determine. The patient wouldn't necessarily know, and they're only diagnosed by the doctor putting their stethoscope on the chest, hearing the erratic beating, confirming it with an EKG.
You know, a buddy of mine was diagnosed with AFib a couple of years ago or a year ago. And apparently, and this is secondhand, so you can take it with a grain of salt or two. The doc told him, yeah, you know, you may have been led to this by COVID. This guy works out. He's a vegetarian. He's in great shape. And he had COVID. And the doc thought maybe there was a connection there. Is there a connection?
Not a specific connection, but all viral illnesses, the common cold, influenza, any type of bad upper respiratory infection that we don't necessarily test and diagnose can trigger AFib.
Hmm. And okay, so it'll trigger it if you have heart-related issues with a virus, but will it go away on its own? Or once you have it, do you have it?
Yeah, that's a great question as well. Would the first one episode in the setting of pneumonia or the flu, would that mean you're destined to be stuck with this condition the rest of your life? We're not sure.
Interesting.
Some people probably have that trigger plus the common reasons to develop AFib: obesity, age, high blood pressure, heart failure, diabetes, sleep apnea. I mean, I'm listing like the big hits, right?
Yeah.
Of adult medical disease. Those are common conditions that lead to AFib.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We're joined by Dr. Robert Fang of Albany Associates in Cardiology. A couple emails here, then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones. This is from Tom in Gardner, Massachusetts. What medications are currently recommended for CHF, and what daily regimen is usually prescribed for the patient, for instance, foods, exercise, etc.? Before you start, what's CHF?
Congestive heart failure.
Okay.
It's a long answer, so I'll divide it up into kind of two broad groups.
Okay.
There's heart failure with what's called preserved ejection fraction, meaning your heart is strong and normal strength of pumping. And then there is heart failure in a weak heart, where the heart is, that ejection fraction number is lower. We find this on an echocardiogram test. So there are certain medicines that are better depending on those categories. So I don't know for the purpose of this discussion if it's going to be helpful for me to rattle off these medical names.
Okay.
No, but I think it's best to talk to your doctor or your primary care doctor or get a consultation with a cardiologist to find out which group you fall into with that echocardiogram test. With diet and lifestyle, low sodium diet is always important because that high sodium fried foods, high salts, canned soup, things like that will make you retain fluid. Mm. We're trying to get fluid off your body.
Yeah.
Because that congestive word in the diagnosis is fluid in your lungs, making it hard to breathe. And so not drinking extra fluid, right? This old adage of 10 cups of water per day.
Yes.
Wrong in the CHF patient.
Really?
We want to restrict it more like 60 ounces, let's say. So if you think of like cans of soda, it'd be like 5 cans of soda worth of volume of liquid, whether that's your coffee, water, juice, milk, add it all up. That heart failure patient, I would restrict it more so that they're not drinking too much, right?
So interesting. All right. Speaking of medical terms that you don't want to define, this email has about 17 of them, so you're going to have to give some definitions to me. This is from Dan in Albany. Given that my 2017 CTA showed extensive non-obstructive plaque in LAD, LCA, RCA, and CAC 1015, CAD RAD score 2, might IVUS be indicated pursuant to the April 8th, 24 Lancet report of the PREVENT trial? I have no idea what I just read.
Yeah, so I'm not going to go into, just to confuse the audience, I'll try to water that down a little bit.
Thank you.
The number in there of greatest importance that most people will see from their doctor's test will be the calcium score, CAC.
Okay.
Coronary artery calcium score. That is not a set number. It sort of varies depending on your age.
Okay.
And we divide it up. If you're 50 to 54, 55 to 60, these different, you know, age groups, there's a sense of what's normal and what's abnormal. What's normal is zero.
Oh, really?
Okay. So you don't want the 1,000. I'm sorry, I forgot the caller's name. The 1,000 is very elevated.
Yeah.
And those three-letter terms, LAD, RCA, those are the actual coronary arteries being described. The left anterior descending, the right coronary artery, those are acronyms for that. But suffice it to say that, you know, when it gets into that situation, you need to have a detailed discussion with your cardiologist about what those findings are. And in a test for an IVUS, that's an invasive test at the hospital. We put catheters in and to the coronary arteries and inject dye, and that's an ultrasound test to look at the severity of blockages.
Uh-huh.
So this is getting into the nitty-gritty.
It certainly is, yeah. And we have a long way to go. So I'm going to take a break, and we are going to take a break, and I'll try to clear my head, and we'll go on. We'll take some calls. 800-348-2551 is our number. Dr. Robert Fang of Albany Associates in Cardiology is here. We'll get to the phones in a moment. When I think AFib, I think Chicago Blues, and there's James Cotton at 800-348-2551. We're joined by Dr. Robert Fang of Albany Associates in Cardiology. Before we get to the calls, I'm very sorry about your Buffalo Bills. It was a very terrible loss last night.
Let's not talk about
that. Yeah, try not to think about it. Now let's just go back to our call. Michael in Washington, Mass. Michael, you're on.
Hi. I have a question. It's like a layman's rule of thumb, and it may not be true. I'd like your opinion. It's that if you nod your head to a heartbeat, that's a normal heart. But if you cannot nod to it, that means it's fibrillating. Is that true?
Hmm.
So,
you ever hear that?
Not exactly, but I think that another way to describe it is people will feel their pulse with their two fingers on their wrist, and they'll say, "Doc, I think it was pretty regular, but a little bit irregular." So I was like, try to figure out what that means. I might tap it on the table. But if it's constantly irregular and there's absolutely no rhythm or pattern, you're likely dealing with AFib. But irregularity per se is not AFib. And let me describe what I mean by that. You can have normal, steady beats, like your head is nodding steadily, and then a bloop, and then kind of steady, steady, bloop, steady, 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 bloop. Now, that's not really crazy irregular, right? The blips, I kind of used a different word to highlight that those are like extra beats mixed into the regular beating, not as irregular as what I was talking about before. And if I got an EKG, that might actually just show me these benign extra beats intermittently kind of interspersed with your normal rhythm. But overall, like a device like your blood pressure cuff might read that as irregular.
Michael.
So people can be fooled a little bit as to saying, I think I might have had AFib, but we need a recording to usually sort it out.
You want to go with a follow-up, Michael?
No, that was a very cogent answer. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it. 800-348-2551. If you would like a cogent answer, give us a call at 800-348-2551. Rachel in Kingston, you're on.
Hi. Actually, my question is, Jane, since listening, I received about 10 years ago an extraordinarily high calcium score, which just went up. I mean, I think it's over 400 now. However, convinced I was on the point of death, they gave me a cardiac catheterization, and they found absolutely nothing and said that I had the arteries and heart of an 18-year-old. And the same thing happened to my sister, and I was wondering what the explanation is for this, because I was trying to get HRT, and they looked at my calcium score and thought I was at bad risk, and they said, but it's not real.
Interesting.
You know, Rachel, I'm glad you asked that, because this is an everyday concern of cardiac patients that we deal with, and that number is not absolute. It's just a marker, and it can represent early onset coronary blockages, but calcium is different than the actual cholesterol buildup inside the artery. So this would be like, let's say you move into a house and you're looking at the plumbing and all the copper pipes look a little old and different, darkened in color, right? They're not that shiny copper color, they're old. And aging will make the calcium go up. I'm not calling you old, by the way. I'm just saying that aging makes this go up. So naturally, we don't keep checking the calcium score as we get older. And in fact, it's not a good test as we get much, much older. So I'm saying over 75, we're not going to use this test anymore. So in the intermediate, like adult population, middle-aged population at intermediate risk, we're going to look at that and might be like people with a family history, but not a lot of other risk factors. And we get that to try to decide, should we be more aggressive with prevention? Maybe we should be more aggressive with getting you your cholesterol numbers down and get on the prevention earlier. Once in a while, somebody does have the inside the coronary artery cholesterol blockages also with that high calcium score. But you're a perfect example how that test does not mean you have coronary blockages. It's not an absolute, you know, result.
Rachel.
And do you think that HRT in someone, a postmenopausal woman who also has been diagnosed with AFib but post cauterization, is a bad idea, or do you think that can be a good idea?
So let's talk about you specifically. The coronary angiogram showing no blockages gives me more comfort to offer you the hormone replacement therapy if your postmenopausal symptoms are bothering you every day. But if someone else had, a different patient, had lots of blockages, prior heart attack, and we don't want to increase their risk of a clot or blockage developing, that person, we would say, you know, probably should avoid the hormone.
Rachel, thanks a lot for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Robert Fang of Albany Associates in Cardiology is our guest today. Just to clarify something you said when you were answering Rachel's question, maybe I got it wrong. Calcium on the outside and plaque on the inside?
Yeah, it's not as simple as I made it sound out, but yes. So the wall of the arteries can build up this calcium. And, you know, if you got a CAT scan for your lungs, and incidentally, there will be coronary artery calcium described in like everybody over 70.
Yeah.
And that will lead to a consult with us, you know? But that doesn't tell the whole story of what's inside.
So, okay, if the calcium is on the outside and is not blocking anything, why do you keep calcium scores and why is it important?
Yes, so the association with real disease inside is something that is helpful with this test.
Yeah.
So it's identifying higher risk people earlier and allowing us to intervene with the preventative therapies earlier. So that means the cholesterol lowering, blood pressure treatment, maybe a baby aspirin. those things to try to minimize the risk of the cholesterol plaques building up on the inside.
On the outside, the calcium. Mm-hmm. Why is it a bad thing exactly? I mean, it's my grandmother used to say, "Oh, he had hardening of the arteries." I assume that's
what we mean.
So why is it a bad thing?
Well, so the arteries can't dilate; they're stiff, and also they do go together hand in hand, but it's not 100% associated. From this, from Rachel's example.
Dr. Robert Fang's our guest from Albany Associates in Cardiology. The number here is 800-348-2551. Bob is in Saugerties. Go, Bob.
Oh, how are we doing? Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I've been an AFib 3 times, and I'm a new car dealer. And
okay.
I'm wondering, does stress have anything to do with going into AFib? Because I think one time or twice I was up against a situation with possibly an employee or a customer, and did that put me in AFib?
Yeah, I think anecdotally, people will have their examples like you bring up. But I would answer to that, there are lots of other times where you were under high stress where you didn't go into AFib. So, you know, high adrenaline states, there's spikes of adrenaline during those moments, you know,
yeah.
Anger, fear, you know, whatever. But does that always provoke AFib? No.
Okay. That's good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bob, you always got to check your manufacturer's warranty on your cardiac system there. Thanks, buddy. Appreciate the call. We'll go to Olav in Pittsfield. Olav, you're on.
Yeah, hey. So I was diagnosed with AFib several years ago. I had the ablation surgery 2-3 years ago. I've had no episodes since. Before that, I was getting them probably weekly. They lasted for a good 12 hours. When I had the surgery, you know, the surgeon said it was for symptomatic relief only, and it would not reduce my risk of strokes in the future. So just wondering if that the case, and, you know, and why. You know, since I'm not having episodes, you know, I'm not getting the pooling of blood, and, you know, and I pick up on the episodes instantly when I would get them.
Right. First off, it sounds like you had a nice result with your procedure because your symptoms, you know, went away. You haven't had recurrences, so that's great. You might, it's
yeah.
intuitive to say, if I'm not having AFib, how could these blood clots form? Why do I need this blood thinner? But unfortunately, the procedure is not 100% cure. And we know the limitations of this because if we place monitors more long-term, we find that people may have episodes that they're unaware of, like while they're asleep or things like that. So we don't go by like how good a result you describe to say that you can be free of the blood thinner. We use the blood thinner based on a risk scoring, based on conditions like congestive heart failure, high blood pressure, age, diabetes, prior stroke. And we go through this kind of, you know, checklist of these diagnoses. And if you have two or more of these clinical points, then we keep the blood thinner long term, because the stroke is the worst possible thing you could have as a symptom of AFib.
All right. Olav, you want to follow up?
I kind of get that. But, you know, like I say, I could pick up on the episodes instantly. I mean, I might be in denial for a minute or two, but I always knew the instant it happened. You know, even if it happened at night, I would pick up on it. So this kind of seems like my risk should be, you know, reduced.
Yeah, we feel like that. We hope that is the case. It hasn't really been proven in large-scale studies that even if you think the result is good, we don't eliminate that stroke risk to zero. So that's why we stick with the more protective strategy of staying on the blood thinner.
Olav, thanks for the call. Dr. Robert Fang is our guest. Now, here's an odd question, but that's sort of what I do. Could you tell if you did an examination of a cadaver and someone who didn't complain of AFib, could you tell post-death if they had AFib and didn't know it?
Not exactly. There might be clues of some of structural changes of the heart that would make them more prone to have AFib.
Okay.
But could I absolutely say that guy had AFib in his life? There would be one way. If we examined the left atrium, found that to be very enlarged, and this little area called the appendage, it's kind of a dead-end little pouch,
yeah,
had a clot in it.
Ah.
I would say, ah, they have an enlarged atrium. They have this little appendage area with a clot. That happens from AFib. And if that clot had left the heart, that would lead to a stroke. So that would be like the smoking gun of kind of like saying this person had AFib history.
Well, the reason I ask such an odd question is it possible that some people go through their entire life with AFib and never are really truly affected by it?
I think if you unfortunately go through AFib long periods of time but don't feel anything abnormal, they could present with a stroke as their first symptom.
Because they can, but do they always?
Not 100%. But the longer you live with constant AFib, the risk of stroke keeps climbing. And the longer you live, then the statistics are against you. You know?
We're joined by Dr. Robert Fang of Albany Associates in Cardiology today. Back to the phones here at 800-348-2551. We go to Copake. It's Andrew's turn. Hello, Andrew.
Hello. I have a problem with AFib. I was diagnosed in 2000. I wound up at the emergency room twice and had to be paddled back into normal rhythm. And I saw my cardiologist, and I have a number of medications that he's given me, mainly propafenone. And I've just gotten onto Xarelto about 2 years ago. So this happened about 25 years ago. I've been on the propafenone for quite a while. And I also take amlodipine and ezetimibe. So what do you think of all those drugs? My doctor seems to think that since it's controlled with the propafenone, I should not have the ablation therapy. Doctor, what do you think?
So you've had a nice go of it with that drug because is the propafenone. Propafenone is an antiarrhythmic drug that stabilizes the rhythm and helps to prevent AFib recurrence. So if you're going 20-plus years with no recurrent episodes, that way exceeds our expectations on the success of a drug because most drugs actually fail at have about a 50% failure rate at 1 year of preventing AFib. So most meds, even these are strong meds like propafenone, don't work very well. So you've had a very good luck with that. Now, just for the audience, paddled means cardioversion. That's a way that we either by paddles in the old ways, we like on TV and charge up and shock. We use these stickers now, and so it's like less dramatic. We just put a big sticker on the right upper chest here and then one on the back on the left shoulder blade. And then once they're sedated and asleep, we deliver electricity, a high voltage shock that will stop the heart basically and interrupt the AFib, and then your own beats come back and start. And that interruption of the AFib is called a cardioversion. It's not a lasting benefit. People say, well, I had a cardioversion, it lasted 20 years, and then I had the next one, and it only lasted 1 year. Doc, what happened? I said, well, they both lasted milliseconds. They were, split-second shock. And it's really like rebooting your computer. Like I did Control-Alt-Delete, and that interruption, and I started up my computer again. But the next time it freezes up and I do that intervention, I'm not fixing anything with the reboot of the computer, right?
Right.
The same thing with cardioversion. That paddling or shock doesn't fix anything. It's just an interruption. So, Andrew, you've done well because of the propafenone suppressing the AFib. It's, you had a great go of it. And what I can say you gained by waiting and not having the ablation yet is when you get to an ablation in the future, the technology has improved and our results have improved and our safety has improved. So it's still a good option for you in the future. But hey, you're doing great with just the medications.
Andrew, thanks a lot for the call. So when you are paddled, in theory and I guess in practice, your heart will go back to the original rhythm. What regulates the heartbeat in the body? And why is that set in stone? It's like an EEPROM. It's a non-volatile memory.
Yeah.
How does that work?
So the specialized conduction tissue in the heart, like we started off with the discussion, the sinus node. So that's your internal pacemaker. So it has automatic activity. So given an interruption of the AFib and given a chance to allow it to wake up and do its own thing, it'll start beating.
But not always. I mean, it'll beat, but will it always go back to where
sometimes
it was?
Sometimes we see a nice long pause with no heartbeat before that kicks in.
That's scary. All right, let's take a break. 800-348-2551. It is, in fact, Medical Monday, if you haven't figured that out. Dr. Robert Fang of Albany Associates in Cardiology is here, back with more of your calls. 800-323. Nope, that's the Fun Drive number, Zach. I'm going to get confused because the Fun Drive's coming up. I'll tell you about it in a minute. Hey, everybody. Beautiful job this morning. We did a special roundtable panel, and we did some fundraising in the middle of that in different spots, and you were fantastic. We raised, I think, $13,000 or $14,000 this morning. So, beautiful. If you haven't done it yet, you can go to WAMC.org right now and make your online pledge. Why is that important? Well, that's how we roll here, and that we need you. That's the main thing. But also, it'll shorten our fund drive. Our fund drive begins October 14th at 6 a.m. 6 a.m. We want to shorten that drive as much as we can in this election season. So make your pledge, WAMC.org. Medical Monday, Dr. Robert Fang is with us from Albany Associates in Cardiology. Let's do a couple quick emails, and then we'll get back to the phones. Lines are loaded. This is from Rosemary. Friend of mine had two strokes this summer at age 41. She's okay, but in talking about it, came up that she has had migraines with Aura since age 12. I get them as well. So she went on to tell me that they discovered she has a hole in her heart. She said that something like 40% of people with Aura have a hole in their heart, which they think contributed to her stroke. So I'm wondering, should I, as a person that gets Aura, be checked for a hole in my heart? And that's from Rosemary.
Okay, that's a very good question about migraine headaches and the hole in the heart. And there are two kind of interesting points I want to bring up. The younger you are, the less likely you're going to have the structural problems of your heart, the heart failure, the AFib. And we kind of left shaking our, you know, kind of shrugging our shoulders. Why did they have a stroke? And when we do imaging of the heart, like by ultrasound, that's echocardiogram, we can see evidence of not really like a hole like Swiss cheese, but like a flap, a residual flap that is still open slightly. And we can do little things to provoke that and see it better. But that flap was open in all of us in utero.
Oh.
We needed that opening to get oxygenated blood from the mom through the placenta, through your umbilical cord. Because as a fetus, you're not breathing. You're bathed in this amniotic fluid, right? So you need to get oxygen somehow. So you're getting it from the mom. But when you're born, that flap just kind of folds over, and you no longer have that opening. And in 80% of people, it actually seals tight, sealed, and is no longer open. But 20% of people walking around all over the world, all of us, if one in five of us have that little flap, why aren't we all having strokes? See, so that's the first problem.
Right.
So we don't necessarily think we have to go and close all of these. If you have strokes or recurrent strokes, we have a scoring system we can go through to assess what's the likelihood of this flap being open, being your cause for stroke. So that's kind of the first half of what I wanted to mention. Anecdotally, people who have had this kind of procedure to close this little flap and who had migraines, their migraines can get better.
Oh, that's
and
so
we don't understand the mechanism there, but it's just an observation. So I guess the answer to her question, should she go and have it evaluated just because she has migraine auras? I don't think so. But her friend may have to meet with someone to determine whether closing that flap would be worthwhile for her for the risk of future strokes.
It occurs to me that 20%, that's a pretty high number for a lot of people walking around with a flap in their heart. Is there any simple diagnostic that you could do that everybody could have at their annual?
Yes, no, just the ultrasound. We need to visualize that. There's no other way.
Dr. Robert Fang's our guest. Fran writes in, what are the criteria for needing a valve replacement, aortic, and what does the procedure involve? Approximate length of recovery. That's from Fran.
Okay, so we have four valves in the heart. The aorta, aortic valve, is the last valve before the blood is ejected from the heart into the aorta, the main artery, the kind of the plumbing. So that valve sees the highest pressure, and it's the same pressure as what we measure in your arm for blood pressure. So it gets a lot of wear and tear. Valve problems are mainly two types. You can get narrowed, calcified, thickened, and they don't open well, or they're wide open and they don't close fully. They're too leaky. So they're narrowed or they're leaky. And either extreme would require a replacement of that valve. In the aortic valve position, you can do open heart surgery or a catheter procedure called TAVR, T-A-V-R. And that's for aortic stenosis, the narrowed situation. And we can go in with a catheter and actually implant a new tissue valve and get you out of the hospital the next day, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Compared to, you know, a week-long recovery after open-heart surgery. So it's been a game-changer, and, it really depends on how severe the leakiness or narrowing is of your valve.
Last email for now, and then we'll go back to the phones with Dr. Robert Fang. But Rob writes in regards to stress, suppose I'm a late 50s male smoker and I really like certain sports. If my favorite team is in a must-win situation in the last regular season game with the playoffs in the balance and we're losing, 2-1, for example, in the fourth, should I turn the TV off and go to bed to help prevent a cardiac event? And that's from Rob. And Rob, I know what you're doing, and now you're making me stressed.
Okay. All of the men in the audience who watch sports with passion have felt this.
Yeah.
And if you've been on, you know, a team that hasn't won much, like my Buffalo Bills, I mean, I'm talking Super Bowls, you know, never winning a Super Bowl.
Right.
We felt this a lot. So, you know, we've been there a lot. So, and was it Rob? I've lived to tell about it, right? So have you. So it's how anybody manages stress, right?
Okay.
I mean, will you let it get so bad that your blood pressure goes so high? That's not so healthy.
I think I can manage the stress of watching the Mets. I don't know about emails from Rob. All right, let's go back to the phones. Dwight is in Latham. Dwight, you're on.
Yes, I would like to know the relationship between loop and the osteostatic hypotension.
Sorry, I missed the word. The relationship between...
The link that you may have in your chest area and relationship between that and osteostatic hypotension.
Hypotension.
So hypotension is low blood pressure. Maybe you mean the other way, hypertension. Yeah, so...
No, hypo, low blood pressure.
Low blood pressure? No, low blood pressure is nice for you.
Dwight, turn the radio down, man, and then we'll see if we can get some more out of the doc on your question.
Yes.
All right, go ahead. Now, give us a little more detail on this, Dwight.
I have a link in my abdominal area, and I'm having it taken out very soon. Can you put a new one in? Does it cause my lightheadedness, or... There's totally different consequences.
I think if I'm reading you right, if you had a treatment of your aorta in your abdomen, in your belly, that might have been an aneurysm. Is that true? Like you had a repair of an aneurysm, an enlargement of your aorta? Like some people...
I don't know.
Okay, some people would have, you know, atherosclerotic disease, which is that cholesterol buildup, but instead of narrowing and blockage, they might have some changes to the wall of the artery that make it bulge out, and that's called an aneurysm.
Right.
You know, and that can be fatal if they rupture. So those can be repaired with surgery, or even vascular surgeons can do things inside the artery with catheters and do some repairs.
Dwight, good luck with the procedure. Appreciate it very much. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number, and it looks like it's Michael in Albany's turn. Hello, Michael, you're on.
Hi. I had AFib, and it more or less, I didn't have any incidents for the, you know, for perhaps a 2-month period. And then last week I noticed when I was sleeping, I woke up and I could feel, you know, my heart beating more. So I checked my heartbeats, and my heartbeat was like 112. To 118. Normally, my heartbeat is low. It's like 47 beats per minute.
Yeah, that's.
So I'm taking Eliquis. So I'm guessing there really isn't much else I can do.
No, there are definitely options for you. I mean, the Eliquis is protecting you every day as the blood thinner, so that even if the AFib comes and goes, you're not developing blood clots and you're keeping your stroke risk as low as possible. So that's your protection. Thus, having that episode in the middle of the night is not an emergency, right? You know, you felt it, you noticed it, but you don't have to run to the ER. You call your doctor and say, you know, report that you're having more episodes of AFib. Now, there's stronger medicines to suppress the AFib so that your episodes are not once every month or two, might even be less frequent than that. And that would be useful to keep AFib away. I should say, as an aside, AFib's a progressive disease. So if we don't control it, it likes to get worse, more frequent, longer lasting, and finally constant. Because as the heart's fibrillating, the left atrium actually gets bigger and
it won't go
changes,
back.
And the properties of the electrical properties of the atrial tissue change. And we say AFib begets AFib, meaning the longer you're in it, the more it wants to stay and become chronic. And so if these symptoms bother you, Michael, then you should talk to your doctor about options of medicine or, you know, the ablation procedure, which is an invasive procedure, but there are ways to minimize your symptoms and, you know, episodes of AFib.
All right.
Yeah, I think I guess what surprises me, they don't last that long. And I was told if you hold your breath, that's a way of stopping it.
It is not. So the bearing down and holding your breath is a way of stopping one arrhythmia, and it's not AFib. And that's, yeah, it's a different type of an arrhythmia. So I wouldn't try that anymore.
Okay. Why would it do harm?
It's just not effective. It might make you feel a little funny or lightheaded, you know, like when you strain and you forget to breathe and you're red in the face.
Yeah.
But it really won't stop this arrhythmia.
All right, Michael, thanks a lot. How many different types of arrhythmia are there?
Well, let's see. We can start in the upper chamber. So we have atrial tachycardia, which is just a fast spot firing. There's extra beats, premature atrial contractions. There's atrial flutter, atrial fibrillation. There's extra beats in the lower chamber called PVCs. There's, you know, ventricular tachycardia, fast rhythm from the lower chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's, you know, abnormal beats coming from the conduction system that we described before. So there's the blocks, and these are like lots of different rhythm problems, fast and slow.
Your day is usually a busy one then.
There's good variety. I like that.
Demo, there you go. Let's go to Hadley, Massachusetts. Alexi, you're on with Dr. Robert Fang.
Oh, hi, doctor. Yeah, my partner sometimes complains that her heart skips a beat. And earlier you were talking to a caller that had extra beats and whether that indicated a problem. And she'll have me listen to her heart, put my head on her chest, and yeah, it'll be otherwise regular, but then it'll skip or pause occasionally.
That is a reassuring description.
Really?
When I hear that, I say, hey, those little pauses are following actually one extra beat. In most instances. And sometimes the patient will feel that single extra beat as a thump, as the actual heartbeat, or a strange sensation up near their neck, or it felt like they took their breath for a second. These are common descriptions, like even momentarily like slightly lightheaded.
Mm.
But they notice those extra beats, but they're wrongly timed, you know, so they're early beats. And right after that early beats, there's like a little, like a second of reset, and then you're kind of back to your steady rhythm again.
Huh.
And that's exactly what you just described. So those are benign. And actually, if I monitor all of us that are on the call, and myself included, we would all have those extra beats every day.
Okay. Alexi, you want to follow up?
Oh, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. To New Jersey we go. It's Josephine's turn. Hi, Josephine.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Fang, I had a concern. My husband has had 9 shocks for AFib, and now he's going for his second ablation. I'm concerned he's got to get another CAT scan, which is equivalent to 200 to 400 x-rays. Should I be concerned?
Well, yeah. So I don't mean yes, you should be concerned. I mean it's right what you said, that we don't want to do too much radiation. But on the other hand, there's information that's important to be gained from that. So because he had prior ablation, we look at the left atrium and the areas where we need to ablate. There are these structures called the pulmonary veins. And we need to make sure those structures look okay, that there wasn't damage from the prior ablation. So, and it helps guide us in the ablation procedure itself. So these tests are usually necessary to, you know, have a safe procedure. So we feel that the benefit of that radiation exposure is worth it. No, we don't want to do that test every year. A similar example would be like a nuclear stress test. We don't want to have those tests every single year, or any kind of CAT scan of the chest every single year. But if this is his second one, that's not bad.
Okay.
And it may be useful for them.
Josephine.
His second one within a year. He had it a year ago.
Yeah, I mean, again, as I said, I don't think it's worth having them every year. But if he's approaching his second ablation, I do get those before the ablation procedure as well.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're Thanks welcome. For the call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Milford, Pennsylvania very quickly here with Dr. Robert Fang. Keith, you're on.
Yes, Dr. Fang, I think you might have touched on something that I was going to talk about. But for years now, I have what my cardiologist calls extra beats. But, you know, as you're saying, I have a pause after that extra beat. And, you know, sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not, but I almost always feel it. But you're saying that that's nothing really to be concerned about.
Yeah, well, you know, let me just clarify that a little bit. So on the one hand, every single person walking the earth has those extra beats, whether they feel them or not. And you're more likely to feel them when you're laying in bed or resting very still and there's not distractions. And you're very unlikely to feel those when you're walking around and doing something physical. So everybody walking the earth has those beats, right? But once in a while, a high number of those extra beats can be problematic. So we'll usually get a Holter monitor, which is a 24-hour recording, so that we can, you know, count up the number of these extra beats per day. And the percentage of those extra beats matters to the cardiologist. Okay, so over 10%, we're concerned. Over 20%, we're definitely going to treat that. And we may cut down the number of those extra beats with medicine. But most people with a normal heart, those beats are not that high in frequency, and we don't need to treat them at all. We just reassure the patient that that's real normal activity.
All right, Pete. I'll turn my own microphone on. That'll be a good idea. Let's go quickly to Bennington, Vermont. Catherine, you only have about a minute here with Dr. Robert Fang.
Oh, great. Okay. I have had very sharp pains that are super fast and dissipate pretty quickly in the past when I was very young, like 18, 19. And then I had told a doctor about it. They sent me to a cardiologist. I think I had a ultrasound and a stress test, and it didn't show anything. I'm now almost 55, and I did start getting them back again, and they're happening at night, and there is an incredibly sharp, painful, takes my breath away in the exact same spot underneath my left breast, kind of like the bottom of it, just to the left.
Ouch.
And I'm just wondering, like, should I, you know, address that again and maybe have it reevaluated?
Well, yeah, so, you know, first off, I would wager that everybody listening in their lifetime had that sharp pain at some point. It's right between the ribs, usually somewhere down on the left side,
yeah.
Kind of like under the nipple,
yeah.
Like there. And it's like someone put a needle right in there and it made you just
yeah.
Kind of catch your breath halfway near.
Literally,
breath.
Yeah.
I know I've had it a handful of times. It's kind of a growing pain of the heart or the lungs. And we don't know why that happens, but it's like a nerve pain right between your ribs.
Mm.
And it's not worrisome
okay.
For
yeah.
A coronary event at all.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Catherine. Thank you for the call. I think most Bills fans, most Mets fans have those pains every now and again.
Oh, you know it.
Dr. Robert Fang, thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Support comes from Dr. John Shen, specializing in endoscopic spine surgery and disc regeneration, treating disc herniations, spinal stenosis, and myelopathy. ENVisionSpineSurgery.com for details. Thanks again to Dr. Robert Fang of Albany Associates in Cardiology for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the emails, except for Rob's, which he took a shot at me, and I'm going to let that slide. Thanks to our engineer, the returning Zach Malloy, rested after his vacation. Amber Sickles, who is perhaps the most busy person in the radio station. She manned the phones for about 10, 15 minutes of this show. Amber, thank you. Thank you. You can say thank you to Amber by making a pledge at WAMC.org right now. Nathan Scheid kicked in for the rest of the time. Thanks, Nathan. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Biting. Julie Hart and Rich Guthrie talk about Boyds with you. We'll see you at 2:00.